From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Eric Westervelt. This is On Point. They're lazy, spoiled, obsessed with selfies and proving their uniqueness. They're tech savvy but can't really commit to a job or a relationship. They're saddled with student debt and either living out of their parents' basement or traveling the world with an Instagram sponsorship. Yep, that's right. We're talking about millennials, or more accurately, millennial myths this hour. A new look at the data shows that this generation we love to hate is actually more rooted, stable, and connected to family than previous generations. This hour, On Point, millennials by the numbers, myths, and reality. You can join us on air and online. Join the conversation. Are you a millennial? Are you frustrated by these stereotypes? Or are some of them accurate depictions of you and your friends? What do you wish older generations knew about you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Louisville, Kentucky, is population economist Lyman Stone. Lyman's an advisor at Demographic Intelligence, an adjunct fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a columnist at Vox. You can find a link to his story, The Myth of the Job-Hopping Rootless Millennial, is just that, a myth, at our website, onpointradio.org. Lyman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Let's start defining our terms a little bit. The Pew Research Center says, you know, millennials are those born between 1981 and 1996. I mean, who is a millennial, and what do we know about their demographic makeup?
I think generational definitions are always a little bit hairy. Sure. You start to get people right on the edge thinking, well, am I a millennial? Am I a Oregon Trail generation, or whatever you want to call a given group? Right. I think as far as I'm concerned, though, I'll use the word millennial as a shorthand, but I'm just talking about younger people under the age of 35. So some of those may be millennials, some may not be, some may be whatever we want to call the next generation. But I don't think that there's a lot of merit to coming up with hard and fast definitions for generational cohorts.
I mean, let's start with a central depiction of them, millennials, in today's economy, though. There's been a lot written about the so-called gig economy, this contract or piecework, you know, that it's less stable than a full-time permanent job. You know, how accurate is this depiction of an untethered, independent workforce from the research you've done?
Right. So if you were to believe sort of the popular narrative, you'd think that the typical millennial is a graphic designer who's doing remote work on their laptop while on vacation in Italy, enjoying some kind of avocado-based food, coming back to their loft apartment in New York.
Avocado on toast.
Back in the U.S. Right.
A latte. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So that's what you would think. In reality, that's not what's happening. What we actually see is that millennials have lower income at this stage in their life than their predecessors did in previous generations. Yet they have much higher debt service due to student loans. They don't necessarily have more debt because they haven't taken on as much mortgage debt, but the cost of servicing their debt is higher. And they're not more likely to work in the gig economy than was the case 10, 20, 30 years ago. Hmm. And what I mean by gig economy here is what the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls contingent workers, people whose work is not regular. It is based on temporary arrangements, freelancing arrangements, temp agencies. All these sorts of things. Seasonal work is also down. So what we see is that the workforce today is, if anything, more permanent and stable than it used to be in the past. And that's true for millennials, and that's true for older folks as well.
So workers working under the sort of gig economy style framework has actually declined in the past decade.
Sure. I mean, there was a survey done about 10 years ago, and we have another one now. Now, they're done at slightly different places in the business cycle. They're done at slightly different times of the year. So you have to be a little careful not to overgeneralize, but I prefer to say there's just no evidence of a substantial change in aggregate. Now, I think what there may have been, what's quite possible, is that the profile of who is working in a gig-based arrangement may have changed. So if you talk to folks 30 years ago about their gig experiences, it was, well, you know, I picked up a job for a few weeks loading steel coils onto a truck for the local mill. Mm-hmm. That was their gig, and that was blue-collar work. Mm. Today's gig economy is much more likely to be white-collar. You know, you're temping in an office. You know, you're temping for something like that, or you're getting a creative job that's temporary. And white-collar work and creative work has a cachet in public perception and media that blue-collar work never will. So it looks like a big shift to gig economy work because people who are visible are having a more gig-type work.
But it's been exaggerated by the media and by others, and people still like to poke fun at that. This is a clip from Family Guy making fun of millennial stereotypes.
Millennials crave things like instant gratification, authentic experiences, and for some reason we haven't figured out yet, improv comedy. Here's one millennial who has a parakeet with 9 million followers on Snapchat. Here's another who single-handedly started the hashtags that canceled 12 network TV shows she found offensive.
Lyman Stone, where did the stereotypes start to really emerge? Did journalists writing on Deadline just start to get it wrong? Did researchers misinterpret data? Because there's this sort of mistype out there that these are rootless gig economy couch hoppers, and you're saying the data just doesn't show that.
Right. I mean, particularly on geographic mobility, the data shows that young people today are far less likely to migrate across state lines or across metro area lines than their parents or grandparents were. And they're about as or more likely to live in the city or town where they were born. And their time living in a given house is about as long or longer as well. I mean, by any of these metrics, we're a very stable bunch. So why does it seem like we're not stable? Well, one is that every generation has had the same complaints about the younger generation.
Sure.
That's just sort of a human universal. But the other is that I think that we've mischaracterized who millennials are. The narrative of who millennials are is basically a story about who well-educated, upper-middle-class white millennials are. And they're returning to cities and they're getting their nice, you know, $15 neighborhood restaurant meals all the time and they're brunching. And some of that is reflecting the minority and immigrant millennial experience, but to a large part, it isn't. So we've exaggerated this sort of upper middle class white millennial experience, the reclaiming of the cities. And it's like, wait, hold on. Did black people not live in the cities 10 years ago? Did young black people not live there? Well, they did, but we just sort of wrote them out of the narrative of a generation.
A racially myopic misunderstanding of some of these trends that are going on.
It's race, it's class, it's all sorts of things. But the point is that a lot of our stereotypes about millennials are very specific to a specific subset of millennials. And it's true millennials are more educated than in the past, but still many of them don't have a college education, let alone a graduate education. So you can't just say, well, the experience of going to grad school is a millennial universal. No, it's not. It's more than previous generations, but it's nowhere close to a universal.
But I want to underscore something you said earlier about the rootlessness. I mean, maybe millennials are actually putting down deeper roots. So that whole idea of a wandering generation is completely miscast. You say the data shows that, you know, they may be less mobile, less likely to switch jobs. Talk about that.
Absolutely. So we have a couple ways we can look at employment. I talked a little bit about geographic data in the past, and I should say that shows up in many surveys, American Community Survey, Current Population Survey. You can look at IRS tax data and verify this. Millennial migration is not extremely, extremely high. But we can also look at job changes. We can look at how long people stick with a certain job. We can look at how many jobs they tend to have, how many employers they tend to have in a given year or over a period of years. And by any of those metrics, millennials are just no more likely to swap out jobs than other generations were when they were the age of millennials now, so under 35, basically. We're just not a more untethered generation. Mm. Now, we do have this perception of being untethered, and I think it's because we've seen a lot of people talk about how, well, to be successful, you need to bounce between jobs, and there's some truth to that, and that is becoming the norm for success. You don't just stick with a company for 30 years anymore. You bounce between jobs, and so people say, well, millennials are the young people who are moving up right now, and that's how you move up is bouncing between jobs. Therefore, millennials must be bouncing between jobs. The trouble you have to understand is that most millennials are not experiencing economic success. Hmm. That is, we are earning less than previous generations. So whenever you find yourself saying, well, the way to succeed is X, your next assumption should be that that is perhaps not typical millennial behavior right now. And it's not that they don't want to. It's that, well, there just aren't that many jobs necessarily for them. But the point here is that these stereotypes about how to get ahead, that's not most millennials. That's a very successful sort of survivorship bias perspective.
Duncan is calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Duncan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Eric. Thanks for having me. So my comment was, I'm 25 years old. I've been with the same company for about 3 years. It is a consultant company, and I would love to be afforded an opportunity with a company that would be willing to work with me through the end of my work cycle to retirement, but I feel like that's just becoming less and less common. The pension culture has disappeared, So these contract jobs are appealing somewhat. Hmm. And a lot of people that I know do switch gigs, jobs very often. But it is, like you said, to climb that ladder. So as much as I don't like this contract culture, it's just not something that's easily available to me to stick with a company for 20, 30, 40 years like it has been in the past.
Duncan, thanks for your call. And Lyman, to Duncan's point, is some of this the nature of capitalism in the 21st century? Companies themselves are in some ways less loyal. The pension system is declined or are gone. The nature of work has changed. So Duncan, as Duncan points out, this is how he has to get by and piece together a living.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I certainly think that, I mean, particularly the retirement environment has changed for millennials. We have a lot of uncertainty. Are we going to get Social Security? What benefits will be available for us when we retire? You know, pensions are far less available. There's a lot more complexity put on a young person about how to manage retirement than in the past. And part of that is because our parents and grandparents did this wonderful thing where they came up with, you know, 57 different tax-preferred vessels you can use to save. But while that's nice once you figure it all out, it's kind of a pain to figure it all out. So there is a new complexity in figuring these things out. I'm not sure if it's actually leading to a huge amount of job churn.
Stay with us. We're discussing millennial rootlessness and other myths. You can join the conversation. Is the country becoming more rooted and less mobile? Is that a good thing? Do you worry it will hamper the economy? Maybe. Are there social impacts? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking this hour about millennials, what the latest numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics actually tell us about this generation. You can join the conversation. Are there millennials in your workplace? You know, are they really all that different from past generations? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest right now is Lyman Stone, a population economist and author of the recent Vox column, The Myth of the Job-Hopping Rootless Millennial is Just That, a Myth. And Lyman, talk a little bit about your job, population economist. What do you study? Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. So you have sort of two different social sciences here. One is demography, that is the study of people and populations and how they change. So that's looking at fertility and mortality and migration and these things. And then on the other hand, you have sort of regional economics, looking at why places succeed, how economic development occurs, this sort of thing. So what I do is try and fuse these, and particularly for forecasting future trends and future population for given cities, states, areas. Take your pick.
Kathleen is calling in from Dayton, Ohio, to join the conversation. Welcome to On Point, Kathleen.
Hi, Eric. I have three daughters, and my youngest is 31, so I know a lot of millennials, and I worked with a lot of millennials in the Sanders campaign, and I find them to be some of the hardest working, innovative, creative people that I've met in a very, very long time. I think your guest, when he said, you know, we're earning less than past generations, especially the millennial generation, and I like to use an example of Mary Frances here in Dayton, Ohio, who's 86, retired from GM in 1996, making $17.50 an hour. Now, even with college degrees, there are people who are not making that, and the standard pay scale here in Dayton, I've been really talking to a lot of workers without high school or without college educations, and the standard pay scale seems to be 11. So that affordability to float your boat is much more of a struggle these days than, like he said, in past generations. But again, I find them to be some of the most creative, innovative, hardworking people I've ever met.
Kathleen, thanks for your comments. Lyman, creative, innovative, but finding it difficult to save. And with that comes, you know, things like home ownership. Talk about what we know about the challenges of buying a home in this economy for the younger generation.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, home ownership has been a huge barrier for my generation. Partly, we came of age during the recession, which inhibited early labor force development, which has a scarring effect on your resume and your earning potential for a very long time. And then even afterwards, even once we sort of started to have the money to buy, the question is, well, do you really want to? You saw what happened to the money your parents plowed into that nice house. Do you want to take that on? So I think there is some generational skepticism. That said, in recent years, as the economy has continued to chug along, we are seeing a lot of increase in home ownership among millennials. Now, the issue is that even once we kind of decide, okay, we're confident that this may be a worthwhile thing to put money into, we may have the money to get a house somewhere, the question is, can we get a house or a condo or something in the city where we live? Mm. And the answer is often no if the city where we live is one of the big booming blue metropolises, right? Whether it's LA, San Francisco, New York, Boston, take your pick. Local land use regulations, which means zoning, which means land preservation rules, which means height limits, parking requirements, take your pick, have just made it extremely difficult to add enough housing supply to build houses for everybody. So our generation, my generation, is having a hard time finding a place where there's a nearby job and an affordable house.
Affordability, Rory is calling from Lowell, Mass., I think speaking to this very issue. Rory, welcome to the conversation. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. I was just going to talk about the recession as well. As having an obvious effect on the economy, I think it's definitely had a big effect on, the minds of millennials. I think millennials are much less likely to take the financial risks that you need to take in order to succeed in this economy. So the millennials that were affected much by the recession are less likely to take these risks than millennials that weren't really affected.
You can't afford to take a financial risk at your age.
Yeah.
Thank you for your call. And Lyman, I want to ask you, it was something you write in your article. I mean, you write that a shift towards increasing rootedness is actually a potentially worrying trend for the American economy and society. How so? Why is that? Talk about that.
Throughout American history, there haven't been a lot of common threads of what it means to be an American. Our identity has changed with every generation, every wave of immigrants, every new political dispensation, series of wars, whatever. We have constantly changed what it means to be an American. And that's actually kind of what it has meant to be an American, is to constantly be changing, right? We've been an experimental country, a country that is always on the move and dynamic. Culturally, that shows up in sort of our ability to absorb totally new waves of immigrants and integrate them and make them American. But it shows up economically as well, with a very dynamic labor market. When times are bad in one place, we get up and move, or we don't move to that place. When one industry collapses, we invent a new industry. This has been the American way. It seems to be less so now.
This is sort of dynamism and mobility of the American workforce could be stymied by this increased rootedness. But just to push back on that, I mean, you've got Silicon Valley, the tech economy, you've got innovations that have come out in the last 20 years that they're quite incredible. I don't think anyone's saying that American dynamism in terms of business innovation has been stifled. What's your take?
Oh, it absolutely has been. If you look at the rate of new business startup in the United States, it is remarkably low. Hmm. If you look at people's ability and frequency of switching jobs, particularly switching jobs to move up the corporate ladder, so to speak, that's quite low. In fact, there's an entire, quite enormous economic literature on the problem of low dynamism. And even when you look at Silicon Valley, it's very impressive. It's very neat to have all these gadgets. How many jobs has it actually made? And the answer is quite a few in San Jose. Elsewhere, Not so many. We're actually not creating these new industries as fast as we really ought to. In Silicon Valley, it's amazing, wonderful. I love it. But it's kind of just one thing. And you can't have just one industry going on. You need a whole panoply of different industries being invented. And particularly in the wake of the Great Recession, there was a lot of study of this. Is we had these big negative employment shocks in some places, a lot of places, but there were other places that had very positive economic shocks, like West Texas and North Dakota with the oil boom, or like actually many tech areas still had a lot of growth, and a lot of urban areas recovered very quickly. The city where I've been living the last 5 years, Washington, D.C., basically didn't have a recession. And yet not that many people actually moved to these boom regions. The amount of migration we got reshuffling from hard collapse regions to ongoing strength regions was far below what any rational model of sort of economically maximizing migration would have suggested we should have had. People stayed in place. They just didn't go looking for a new opportunity.
I'd like to bring in another voice right now, and joining me from San Diego is Jean Twenge, a professor of psychology at San Diego State University. She focuses on generational differences. She is the author of Generation Me, Why Today's Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and More Miserable Than Ever. Jean, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So you've been listening to the conversation. Do you think Lyman has a point? Have we exaggerated and got some key things wrong about millennials?
Well, yeah, I think there's some really interesting data. It's a great article, and there's certainly a lot that is very consistent with much of the data that I analyze. So I focus primarily on really large national surveys of young people. So often it's high school seniors or those who are beginning their college education. And the idea about, oh, millennials just want to, they want to hop from one job to the other. That's what they want to do. Well, the big survey data suggests that 18, 19 years old, no, that's not what they want. They millennials are actually a little more likely to say that they would rather stay in the same job. So what they want and what they may end up getting from the current economy could end up being different, but it doesn't seem like that is something that they really want to do necessarily when they're starting their careers.
So turnover rates are actually lower today. Jean, what do we know about, what does the data tell us about millennials, urban versus rural? Are millennials more urban than their predecessors, or has that been exaggerated as well?
Well, I think that's something that Lyman's article addresses more than the data that I analyze.
Lyman, you want to step in on that? What does the data tell us about urban versus rural?
So millennials are, for their age group, they're a little bit more urban than past groups. But part of that may just be that when it was getting to be the age to buy homes, they were locked out of credit markets, and so they had to stay in rental units, and rental units bias towards urban places. It's not clear how much of this is choice versus sort of pushed into it. But now millennials are suburbanizing very quickly, and even at peak, the difference in urbanization rates was pretty modest.
Emmy is calling from Portland, Maine. Emmy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me. I am 24 years old, and like many other millennials, I'm also burdened by student debt. And in my experience, I've noticed that this economic oppression has really sparked a sort of mini political revolution among millennials, and so I was just hoping you can speak to the trends amongst millennials regarding political activism and engagement and sort of how that relates to the economic state of our class.
That's a great point. Thanks for your call. Jean Twenge at San Diego State University, has this sparked an increase in political engagement among this generation, the fact that they sort of came of age during a recession?
Well, not so far. Now, the data is only updated through 2016, so there certainly could be trends after that. But at least up until 2016, the picture for millennials and the generation after them, iGen, so those born roughly 1995 and later, actually points in the other direction, that they are less interested in getting involved in politics than Gen Xers and boomers were when they were young. And it's pretty universal across the board, no matter what you're asking about. One of my favorite items is, do you want to write to a public official to try to influence things? That's so much easier now that you can, in a few clicks, find an email for your congressional representative. It used to be you'd have to go to the library, find the address, buy a stamp, all of that stuff. But still, millennials and iGeners are less likely to say that they're interested in doing that than Gen Xers and boomers who are when they were young.
So there are cases of high-profile public political engagement, but you're saying as a generation, it's not, it's just not bearing out in terms of activism, rebelliousness. They're less rebellious in some ways.
Well, iGen is certainly less rebellious, at least on average. But you're right. This is what happens a lot of times with some of these cases, that you will have these very high-profile people who are politically active. And those results that I'm mentioning, which are the average response of young people, are, of course, don't negate the impact of those high-profile individuals who are very active.
Lyman, you want to weigh in on this, on what the data tell us about political engagement? She's saying it's just they're not as engaged as some think.
No, I think that's I don't know the exact data on levels of engagement, but I would say of political engagement, but I would say that sounds right, because what I do know is it's not just political engagement. Look more broadly at civic engagement, whether it's social clubs. Volunteering millennials do a little better, but if you look at churches or other religious associations, if you look at neighborhood associations, sports leagues, they're somewhat similar, though it looks like that might be declining as well. Military, any pillar of civic life, younger generations are less involved than a lot of their elders were. Now, I think that that Gene can probably actually give a more holistic explanation for why that may be than I could, about, you know, what is driving sort of this young person disengagement from what we might call sort of external or physical or serendipitous forms of community.
We're talking millennials, fact, fiction, reality, myths. Benjamin from Calhoun, Georgia. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was just going to talk about my situation. I would love to be politically involved, but my workplace has very different political views than me. I fear for losing my job. Stability is more important to me than just about anything else. And I'd love to move to be able to get somewhere where I could, you know, go for a better job. But losing the safety net that my parents provide in my hometown, I just can't afford it with my student loans that I can never not pay. You know, I can't afford to lose that.
Mm. Benjamin, thanks so much for your call. Gene or Lyman, whoever wants to take that. I mean, as we talked about earlier, Social Security, there's concerns. Will that be around when this generation is near retirement? The decline of pension plans and retirement savings. And, you know, as the caller just mentioned, Benjamin, you know, he can't afford to move. He's struggling.
Well, I mean, this is the message, I think, of the economy and of our culture in general that millennials have absorbed is, you're on your own, that a lot of these safety nets are going away, that, yeah, who knows if Social Security will even be around for Gen Xers, which is my generation. Nobody knows. Pension systems are going away. And this is, in some ways, the economic manifestation of a larger cultural trend toward individualism, more focus on the self and less on social rules. It's not all good or all bad. It has trade-offs. But it is really essential to understanding the psychology of our culture, and particularly of millennials, that they are more tolerant and have less prejudice because there is more emphasis on the individual rather than on groups. But it also gets to at least one of the reasons why they're not as civically engaged and interested in joining groups, because they were raised with the philosophy of you depend on yourself and your immediate family, and that is individualism in a nutshell.
And Lyman, do you want to weigh in real quick on that in terms of civic engagement, more focus on the self?
Right. So I think sometimes millennials get characterized as irresponsible, but if you look at all the data, it's the exact opposite, that we are an absurdly conscientious generation. We were told, get an education, you'll get a job. And so we got an education, and then we didn't get a job. We were told that, you know, don't have a child too early, and so we had the lowest teen pregnancy rates of any generation in our past. Time and again, millennials show up as excessively conscientious, and I do mean almost excessively so.
We'll talk more after the break. We're discussing the generation some love to hate millennials, looking past the stereotypes to look at the data and what we know about this generation. I'm Eric Westervelt. More to come. You're listening to On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
This is On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. Today we're talking about millennials, specifically what the data shows about this generation, what it means for the future of the country. You can join the conversation. Millennials are getting married and having kids later in life. Should we worry? Is that a concern or not? If data shows millennials are turning inward, spending more time with family and close friends, less civically engaged, do we risk not understanding those who might be different from us? You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are population economist Lyman Stone and Jean Twenge at San Diego State University. She's a psychology professor who studies generational differences. And back to the point of civic engagement, let's go to the phones. And Christopher is calling from Detroit, Michigan. Christopher, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, Eric. Oh, hi, Eric. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead. What's on your mind?
I think for me, I'm 29 years old. I'm African American. I'm originally from the South Side of Chicago. And ever since I was 19, I worked on campaigns. This is actually the 10th campaign I've worked on in the last 10 years. This is the 9th state I've lived in those 10 years. And I do think that millennials are getting involved because if you look at a campaign, not from the top where senior staff, but everyone else, like in field offices or regional field directors, field organizers, really the cap off age is really around 30 years old. And I do think a lot of them are getting engaged. I do think it's easier, but even with the expectations of even myself being someone, a transient millennial because of the work that I do, I do think there are a lot of sacrifices that millennials don't talk about. Even the expectation of being married. I thought I was going to be married like my father and his father and his father, married by 25, kids by 27, and I'm 29, eating McDonald's out of a car, getting ready for election day tomorrow. This is not how I saw my life 10 years ago. But I also think when we talk about millennials, we do have to be conscious of what their situations and jobs are, because I do think that makes a very big impact from someone who works at an office to someone who is a transit worker or a truck driver or a union worker or a white-collar worker. So I find it very tricky when we talk about millennials as a whole.
Of course, it's tricky to talk about any generation as a whole. We appreciate your insights and your thoughtful comments. Postponing marriage, kids, home ownership. Jean Twenge, resonate with some of what you found or no?
Yes and no. So for working on a political campaign, if you look at the big national surveys, it's pretty much of a constant, if anything, has gone down by a little bit between boomers and millennials, because certainly, yeah, a lot of the campaign workers are going to be young, but that has always been true, and the young people used to be of a different generation. But in terms of the marriage and family piece, there's some really interesting trends that show up in that national survey data, that if you look at the millennials born in the 80s, for example, they were actually more interested in raising a family, and they were more likely to say that was important than boomers did when they were young. in the 1970s, 1960s. But then starting around 2004, for both entering college students and the high school seniors, there started to be a pretty big slide in the percentage who said that raising a family and having a good marriage and family life was important. So as you get to the millennials born in the 1990s, and especially as you transition into the generation I call iGen, which I wrote a book on, came out a year ago, those born 95 and afterward, there's a real move away, at least from when they're 18, 19 years old, for what they say is important, away from marriage and family.
And Gene, in your book, iGen, one of the part of the subtitle, these are kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy. Talk about that aspect. What did you find in your book when you talk about less happy and unprepared for adulthood?
So there's a really pronounced shift between millennials and iGen in terms of life satisfaction and happiness and optimism and expectations. Anxiety, depression, kind of across the board, more of the most sudden shift I had ever seen in 25 years of doing this type of research. Usually the generational transition is gradual, but this was a rather sudden change that happened around 2011 or 2012, which I had to try to puzzle out, you know, what could have possibly caused that. It didn't line up with economic factors because that's when the economy was improving. So it could be partially growing up during a recession, but then you would have expected that change to happen a little sooner. But it could also be that iGen is the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with smartphones. So they are communicating with their friends a lot more online. And at least among these teen populations, in these big surveys, they're saying that they're spending less time hanging out with their friends face-to-face than previous generations did when they were teens.
More screen time, less face-to-face time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. Let's take another call, get some folks into the conversation. Ken is calling from Troy, Michigan. Ken, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Eric, Gene, and Lyman. My comment is that I think there's a tendency here that we may be characterizing things that are really more human than they are either American or millennial. Humans have been forced for economic or political reasons to move around the planet. That's how we got out of Africa and developed the entire globe. And our desire really, I think, is to stay in one place and to get the support that we can from our parents, or to provide support to aging parents, and to have the financial and emotional structure around us that makes our lives good. But when we have to move, then we do. And I think that's a big issue for us politically right now in this country, is the failure to realize that that's a really human thing, and it's born of a desire to make our lives with our family better. And I'd love to hear your guests' comments on that.
Thanks for your call. Lyman, you want to take that? Sometimes you got to move. I mean, this is a generation that, you know, grew up, came of age after the recession, and we always see spikes in mobility after a recession. And he's saying this is part of a broader human trend of movement.
So I guess I would simplify this by saying that there is something even more universal and human than migration, and that is having babies. Everybody does it. And yet some people do it more than others. Some countries have more babies than others. And it's the same with migration, right? Mm-hmm. That it used to be the United States was a country that moved a lot more than other countries. And I don't just mean immigration. I mean within the country. We had a lot more internal migration. And that's even after the closing of the frontier. I'm talking as recently as the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we had a lot more internal migration than you see in other countries. That has changed. We're now much more comparable to other countries. And that's true for fertility as well. Going back to the 1600s in the United States, we had higher birth rates than most European countries. In fact, whenever visitors would come to the United States and walk around like Alexis de Tocqueville, one of the things they comment on is, wow, look how many babies American women have. That changed. It changed a while back in general, but we've had a stark decline in birth rates in the last 10 years, and we're close to record lows. So these are human universals, and it's not like we're the only people in the world who migrate, but historically we've done this more than others. Mm-hmm. That sort of you move when you have to, well, that's true, but the question of what it means to have to move varies. You know, people have different tolerances for discomfort where they are, and Americans have historically had a pretty low tolerance for less than the best. They've said, well, this isn't the best place for me. I'm going to move. Even if I have to abandon the shop that my dad built and leave behind my parents in Germany, I'm moving, and maybe I'll pay for them to come later. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a guy just yesterday who his family was Armenian, but they were in Shanghai before World War II, and some of the family made it to America, and they had to wait for a number of years to bring the others out of Shanghai, and being in Shanghai in World War II wasn't a pleasant place to be. But you know what?
Sure.
They made the move, and they just couldn't bring the others yet.
Gene, you focus on generational differences. Talk a little bit about the history of that intergenerational conflict. I mean, older generations have always been sometimes harsh critics of younger generations, saying that, you know, don't work as hard, aren't as inventive or creative. Talk a little bit about that history and what you found in your research.
Yeah, I think that is why it's so important when you study generations to not go around and just interview older people. Hey, what do you think of these people in your office? That really doesn't tell you a whole lot.
Right.
From a scientific point of view, it's much better to go to the source, to go to young people themselves and ask them, how are you spending your time? How are you feeling? What kind of things are you interested in? What's important to you? And that's what's wonderful about these really large surveys that have looked at young people over the decades. You know, they go back to the 1960s and 70s and really allow us to look at the generations when they were young and starting out their careers and starting out their lives. And that gives us a really good picture that doesn't have that bias of, you know, the potential of older people criticizing. We can say, well, you know, young people, what's up with you? And compare it.
Let's get James into the conversation. He's calling from Tampa, Florida. James, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much, Eric. Appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a couple of comments, which was kind of brought up earlier. So I work in the tech industry, and back in the late 90s is when I started. Mm-hmm. And back then, if I got resumes, I was a manager back then, and if I got resumes in, and if basically it showed somebody was, we classified them as job hopping if they stayed anywhere more than 3 years. Now, 18 months is nothing, and it's not a consideration anymore. And my belief is a lot to do with this is, and I'm not complaining about this, it's just, I'm just stating a fact. You should know the pension systems are pretty much gone, except for the people that are, you know, receiving the pensions because they've retired. And so companies have relied on 401k plans and so forth. Well, what does that do? Well, that puts pressure on the companies to increase shareholder value. Whereas people may have a lot of cash in the market, you know, they're also buying stocks. So there's a lot of shareholder value. So if you're a company and you look at shareholder value, you say, okay, so how can we bring the shares up? Well, the operational cost, one or two, in the top two, is either real estate or payroll.
So, James, you're saying companies incentivize high turnover in some ways.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, so for instance, you know, I've been a manager up and down since then, and it used to be, it was pretty easy to get somebody at least a 4% pay raise. Now, you know, 2%, and then I had employees that got nothing. And so, you know, they would look elsewhere. I have a friend that works in the professional relocation business, and what do you call it?
Well, we see your point, James. Thanks a lot for calling. It's a great point. I mean, and I guess, Lyman, to you, I mean, real wages, it's a great economy, but real wages are not keeping up, are not growing. It's sort of stumping some economists saying, why, if the economy is doing so well, are real wages not going up? It partly gets to his broader point he was just making.
Right. I mean, I'm not going to be able to solve the productivity puzzle right here in a minute. But I mean, yeah, real wages haven't been rising aggressively by any metric. You know, depending on how you adjust for inflation, I think the best estimates do suggest that real wages have been rising, just not as fast as we would like them to. But that's certainly also impacting the sense of dynamism in the economy. But I think when we talk about this job hopping, I think he actually raised a very good point, which is, well, it used to be that in our, you know, fairly white collar, more upper class business, we thought job hopping was bad. Now we assume it's normal. The reason the gig economy is prominent now is not because it's more common. It's because it's more common among more upper-class individuals. Hmm. It used to be folks with gigs, with temporary jobs, were blue-collar, lower-class people bouncing between low-quality jobs. Now, they're highly competitive upper-class workers getting raises by moving. And so it's not that it's more common. It's that the class character of job hopping has changed.
It's On Point from WBUR and NPR, and Deborah is calling from Owl's Head, Maine. Deborah, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you, Eric. Hi. I just wanted to bring up the issue of the federal deficit. In the 2017 budget, every dollar that we pay in our taxes, 14.2 cents, goes immediately from the top to pay off the interest only on the debt. And I don't understand why these millennials aren't enraged and engaged on this issue.
Thanks. Good question. Gene, you want to take that one? Why isn't there more? Where is the outrage, as Bob Dole once said about Bill Clinton?
Yeah, well, you know, millennials are in a tough spot. So, you know, on the one hand, they were raised with these ideas of like, you know, look, you're on your own, and let's focus on what people can do as individuals. And there's this move away from any kind of group or civic engagement. And they're also in this economic squeeze where they want to have kids, but they are having a hard time being able to put those things together economically and having a hard time, you know, affording houses. So they're, you know, squeezed in terms of interest, time, and money in terms of being able to do anything about a lot of these big issues.
Gene, talk a little bit about how our view of millennials has changed over time. You've written two different books, iGen and Generation Me, two different segments of the millennials. How has our understanding changed?
Well, you know, I think millennials, it's the very first characterization was of them as uniquely community-oriented, and I think that rumor got started because they were volunteering more as high school students, but what seemed to not be recognized is they were volunteering more in high school because they were required to do so to graduate from high school because their boomer principals put it in place as a graduation requirement. And then as the data came out, it became more obvious that they were actually moving away from civic engagement and groups, and that individualism in both its good and not so good aspects really characterized them more. So iGen is, they are not millennials. They are a new generation. There's a very pronounced change in a lot of the indicators around optimism and happiness and expectations, even some things around jobs, where there's you know, much more pronounced break between those born, say, in the early 90s and the late 90s than there was for some of the other generational transitions.
Thank you so much, both. Thanks to all who called. Thanks to Lyman Stone and Gene Twenge. You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt.